your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
We are roiling, especially here in the Bay Area, probably since the Trump even nomination. Their passions have escalated, and that carries through to the workplace. People are very passionate. What can they say? What can't they say? They're certainly afraid of offending. They like finding kindred spirits. Of course, the extent to which restraint in what one can say, to the extent to which that occurs, you're going to end up with a less robust set of conversations around specifically work issues, and certainly a mitigation of the chemistry that is crucial to people working together in this environment in which we talk about teamwork and collaboration being so central to the effective workplace. Well, I got the right guy to talk about this. After getting his bachelor's from Yale, PhD from Penn, Jonathan Haidt became a social political psychologist, in part by his own admission, to help more Democrats get elected. Well, now he considers himself more of a centrist, focusing on how to get people of different opinions to civilly explore each other's positions, whether in the workplace or in the university. He is in the university. He is professor of ethical leadership at NYU School of Business. John Haidt was named one of the, and I'm quoting here, top global thinkers by Foreign Policy magazine, and one of the, and again I'm quoting, top world thinkers by Prospect magazine, which, if you're not familiar with it, is Britain's leading monthly current affairs magazine. He's also co-author of a new book published by Penguin Random House, The Coddling of the American Mind. Jonathan Haidt, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thank you, Marty. Pleasure to be here with you.
Good. Well, you know, you have been in the middle of the vortex of all this roiling, whether it be political or otherwise. You're a human being. You know, we tend to think of thought leaders as kind of icons, but not human. How is John Haidt, the human being, reacting, for better or worse, or simply different, from all of this exposure that the mild-mannered academic that you were no longer is?
Yeah. Well, so I've been studying morality and politics for the last 20 or 30 years, and I, you know, as you mentioned, I switched my research over from studying cultural differences in morality to studying political differences in 2004, because I just couldn't stand it that the Democrats kept losing, that they had no idea how to talk about American morality, and I was going to help them. And in the process of reading conservative and libertarian writings, I discovered something that, you know, great thinkers have known for the millennia, which is you can't really understand something until you've looked at it from multiple sides and heard smart people making arguments against it. So I learned a lot from reading conservative intellectuals, conservative philosophers, and so I call myself a centrist in the sense that philosophically I'm in the center. Now the two national parties have had very different evolutions over the last 20 years, and I do believe the Republican Party has been subject to some processes that have made it certainly lose most contact with what it means to be a conservative, lose contact with reality in many cases. So I have no sympathy for the Republican Party, but I do have a great deal of interest in a variety of political and philosophical perspectives. But actually, wait, that's not the question you asked me. The question you asked me is, how is it affecting me?
Yeah.
And the answer is, right after Trump was elected, for most of 2017, actually, I was really getting quite nervous personally, because I had kind of staked out a position saying, you know, we all have to listen to each other, but this was something new, and a lot of my friends on the left were really losing their minds, with anger, and I thought that my position, I mean, I have tenure, I'm not going to be fired, but I thought I could be hated, I could be shunned. So I was actually quite nervous last year, and I found myself reading a lot of Marcus Aurelius and Stoic meditation,
stuff, just, right?
You know, especially during the weeks when we thought that there could be a nuclear war. I mean, it was just an insane year. But now I think I'm a little more grounded, and I think a lot of people are beginning to look past Trump and to say, you know, we do have to have some people thinking about the long-term viability of country, because I think it is in question.
I wanted to just start by introducing you as the human being, but this show really is a fairly bright-lined circumspection around career. So how is your book, The Coddling of the American Mind, and the passions regarding politics and maybe in general about ideology, how is your book and this kind of thinking relevant to a person's career success or the workplace?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, it depends what generation you are. So if you are under 25, if any of your listeners are Gen Z or iGen, mm-hmm. then the book is for you. We basically wrote it for you because we think that the way kids have been raised, they've been enormously overprotected. Any of your listeners over age 40, I ask you to think, when were you let out as a kid? When could you walk around your neighborhood, go out with your friends? And the answer is almost certainly age 6, 7, or 8. But when I do this, I speak at universities all over the country. I ask the students or people under 24, and the answer is usually 12, 13, or 14. So for a lot of reasons, we've overprotected Gen Z, and they are much more anxious. They are much more thin-skinned. It's not their fault. We did this to them. So if you're young, the book is for you to help you recognize what's happened to your generation, why you have such high rates of anxiety and depression that are really going to be obstacles to career success. Now, if you're not iGen or Gen Z, as most of your listeners are not, then the next thing is, well, you're going to be hiring recent college grads. And they're going to be very, very different from the millennials. This is what a lot of people don't understand. A lot of people think that college students now are millennials. They are not. The millennials were born between 1982 and 1994. Kids who were born in 1995 and later are the first ones ever to have social media from the time they were like 11 or 12 even. And it seems to have changed in a lot of ways. So you need to understand Gen Z, we'll call them, if you're going to be hiring them. And then finally, if you just want to get general lessons for career success, I think you'll like the first three chapters of the book on the three great untruths, ideas so terrible that anybody who believes them is almost certain to fail in life. And they are, what doesn't kill you makes you weaker, whereas in fact, people are anti-fragile, we gain from adversity. The second one is, always trust your feelings, when in fact, we tend to go with our gut, but we often have to have formalized ways of questioning our intuitions and improving them. And the third great untruth is life is a battle between good people and evil people. And human beings have always been prone to believe that, to get sucked into a pointless battle of us versus them. Just think about how bitter conflicts at work can be and how some of them can stretch over years and how much that saps your happiness and your productivity. So we talk about that and ways to escape from that kind of us versus them mindset.
I want to focus in specifically about the workplace. Most of the listeners to public radio are not 20, and they are not looking for a job. They are employed, and many of them are not in a position to hire. But you mentioned something that I think is very relevant to the large percentage of listeners who are in the workplace. Many liberals these days consider conservatives evil. Many conservatives consider liberals naive. I've had a number of clients, I'm a career counselor, who say they will not work for an organization that mainly has Republican employees. Is there a realistic way to get both sides to fair-mindedly consider opposing views, period?
Yes, there is. So that's what my book, The Righteous Mind, was all about. I used to teach a course in political psychology at the University of Virginia. I was there for 16 years. And I found that having people read the best writing from the other side, and then I would assign them to go talk to real human beings on the other side. And what they almost always reported is, you know, I thought they were going to be evil, horrible, nasty people, but they're actually really nice. And then once you have a language for talking to them, you actually can connect. So my team and I here at NYU, we created a program that's very easy for any group to learn how to communicate among themselves and to avoid these pitfalls, the needless hostility. If listeners go to go to openmindplatform.org, it's a free program. You can anybody can use it. You can set up an account for your team, your group, your company, send out the link, If everybody does the training, it's five steps. You learn all kinds of skills for talking across divides, and people really enjoy it because we're locked away from each other. And hate is kind of fun when we do it together. We hate the other side, but actually, it's uplifting. It's heartwarming. It's affirming when you can cross bridges and say, "Wow, I hated you for so long, but actually, you're a human being. You're my coworker. You're my friend, even perhaps." There's ways to overcome it, and go to openmindplatform.org.
And for those listeners who are not going to do that or read a book, but who are, I want to paint a picture of the workplace that I am seeing. There is very little talking about politics unless you're careful to, that you're with a kindred spirit. But
right. There
is, everybody is more careful. Everybody's walking on eggshells, especially people of different races, genders, sexual orientation. Not so much sexual orientation here. There's a great deal of comfortability with the full range of sexual orientations here. But around race and gender, people are polite. And in the workplace, polite but not willing to really give very honest feedback, which is, of course, feedback is critical to growth, to getting better ideas for the workplace. So let's take the challenge of saying people who are not going to be reading books or following your five-step model program, but what can you share here to those listeners who are in those workplaces where people are unerringly polite, but because there is the undergirding tension is so great, in part because of politics related to whether it be liberal, conservative, Trump, or gender or race, what kind of advice would you have for people in those meetings, day in and day out, in today's workplace, for profit or nonprofit?
I guess I'd have to say that if you don't want to do any training yourself, and if there's no leadership, so this is crucial. We've had a culture war since the 90s, but it's so much worse now, and it's gotten so much more intense in the last 2 years. So good leaders, I'm beginning to talk about this whenever I speak to business groups, leadership is needed. You have to set norms. The millennials seem to have had this aspiration. Bring your whole self to work. We want to, you should bring your whole self to work. Well, that was a kind of a dream until 2 years ago, perhaps. I think it's got to stop. We really can no longer bring our whole selves to work when we are this divided. Mm. So I think we need clear leadership to explain why we're going to have to keep politics out as much as possible. We're going to make mistakes. We've got to give each other the benefit of the doubt. We're all in the same boat. We all have a stake in this company succeeding. We think we have a great product. We think we do right by our customers, and we can blow it all if we turn on each other. So I got to ask you folks, keep the politics out of work, and when someone slips, you give them the benefit of the doubt. I think that in general, given how divided we are, it is probably best to not talk much about it. Now, the danger is that, especially in an area like the Bay Area, where the politics leans pretty heavily to the left, there are always some conservatives, and it's not just conservatives, it's also libertarians and centrists, who will feel shut up. They will feel stamped down, and they will be resentful. And so that is something that leadership does have to address, does have to have an open door, does have to say, come to me if you feel that. Some amount of it is going to be inevitable, but especially when, we need your input, we need your criticism of stupid things we might do because of our absence of open discourse. So it's going to take leadership to get us through this.
Let me take a specific example. Today, especially here in the Bay Area, a person often, nothing occurs all the time, but can often benefit from claiming victimhood by race, gender, sexual orientation, whatever. But if, let's say, you are a person, it doesn't matter whether you're a leftist or you're a centrist or you're a conservative. If, let's say, you're their boss. Let's say I'm the boss. And I suggest to that person, you're invoking the race, gender, sexual orientation, elitism. There's a lot of labeling going on in meetings. I'm worried, A, that it's hurting the group's ability to produce, and it could be, again, nonprofit. It hurts our ability to provide services to the poor, and it's making you less self-efficacious because there's so much anger in you, so much your antenna are so out for race, gender, sexual orientation, that you are probably suffering in terms of your own career. And quietly, although nobody says it, people are unlikely to want to champion you in your career. Now, if I said that to such a person, if I'm that person's boss, I am at risk, especially if I'm a white male, of being called racist, sexist, whatever, and that person going to HR. What advice would you give to me if I'm the boss of a person who is invoking the race, gender, sexual orientation, victimization thing? How would you recommend I handle that?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is we all have to recognize how good we are at diagnosing problems in others and how poor we are at diagnosing it ourselves. I think Jesus and Buddha and sages in every society have said it better than I just did. Of course, it is quite possible that the environment really is toxic or nasty to women or to people of color, and you wouldn't know that. You really might not know that if you're the boss and you're an older generation. So the first thing is you really have to be sure before you ever reproach someone for claiming to be a victim, you've got to make very sure that the person isn't really a victim. And you've got to get, you know, talk to people in the company and do, you can do culture surveys. I run an organization, co-run it, called ethicalsystems.org. We're working on a free culture measurement tool that small to medium size, and any size company, but it's ideal for small, medium sized companies, can use. So first do some self-study and find out if this view is widespread. And if employees are seeing it, well, then you really have a culture problem. But if all the signs are that people are generally happy, that members of various groups are pretty satisfied, and it's just one employee who is playing the race or gender card, well, then it's a very, very different kettle of fish. As for how you deal with it, obviously there's all kinds of issues of employment law that you have to be careful of in lawsuits. In general, I would suggest go right out and read Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, because there are ways to de-escalate, and they often start with acknowledgement. Try to find some way that the person is right, that you can meet them partway and say, I validate a concern that you have. That doesn't mean that your whole story is right, but odds are the person is right about something. So these are very tricky situations, because if you go in, you know, as you were suggesting, or at least as many, you know, many older white men might be inclined to go and say, hey, come on, you're playing the race card, you're being a victim, it's bad for you, you know, don't do that. Well, that's likely to backfire. This is a very tricky situation, and try to do it gently and with some psychological skill.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Jonathan Haidt. He is the author of The Coddling of the American Mind. We are talking about how to encourage truly diverse exchanges in today's workplace. And I'd like to invite you to call. If you are in a workplace where there has been kind of a stifling of free expression around touchy issues, especially it relates to the workplace, but where maybe some of these thorny issues like anti-Trump versus pro-Trump or women's issues or men's, I don't know if there are men's issues allowed these days, but women's issues or people of color issues. If you have your story you want to tell or a problem you're actually facing or face that you'd like to ask of my guest, Jonathan Haidt, I invite you to call. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You advocate for civil exchange, but some people are saying, including many here in the Bay Area, I live in Berkeley, and recently there was the very rare conservative speaker who came to campus, and Antifa, a violent group, they broke store windows, they beat up people, etc. And in the end, it works for, you know, the American Revolution. You know, if we didn't have a violent American Revolution, we'd probably still be under the British hegemony. When police shot a black man twice, there were the community burned down two cities, and it resulted in billions of dollars of extra aid to inner cities and countless colleges and workplace workshops on implicit bias. Can you really tell people to be collaborative and sharing of, you know, being conciliatory and civil, when in fact very often violence is what works?
Well, first, let's be very clear about the context here. There are contexts in which violence is necessary. If you're faced with an armed enemy that wants to kill you, then violence might well be necessary. If you're faced with a system such as the criminal justice system, which in many parts of it does seem to have serious race problems and serious there are serious injustices, then there is it might well be that very forceful protests are necessary. But I would question most of your examples as to whether they actually worked. When you burn down cities, when people riot, when Berkeley students protested violently against Milo Yiannopoulos, they set the left back enormously. Those kinds of videos, boy, do they play on right-wing news. Boy, do they make many people who are somewhat moderate turn against students, universities, and the left. If you look at what's happened to support for universities across the country, Democrats are down. Well, they were up a little bit after the protests of 2015, but now they're down a little. Republicans are way, way down. They used to like universities. Mm-hmm. Now they dislike them. Mm-hmm. So most of our state governments are controlled by Republicans. The violent student protests have really backfired. In fact, why do you think Milo Yiannopoulos calls his tour, or he used to call it, the Troll Academy Tour? His whole goal was to provoke the left to violence, because when the left is violent and it's caught on 97 iPhones, and there are scenes of people literally beating other people on the head with pipes, your side loses.
Yes.
This is not helpful. I would even question your examples of burning down cities and getting federal money. It's not clear the federal money helped. Bureaucratic agencies and entities can be forced to do something, not to fix the problem, but to do what is politically expedient mm-hmm. to give them cover.
Yep.
So you can provoke organizations into action, but it's not going to actually help you necessarily.
In the longer run. Let's turn to, you're a social psychologist, and as you well know, and I think some of your tweets have even pointed this out, social science fields in general have been damaged because attempts to replicate the social science findings have often failed, in part
yes.
because of investigator bias, and in part because it's simply tough to do social science research. There's so many covariates that can't be controlled.
Yes.
If someone were, and this is a career counseling type question, if
yeah.
one of your advisees asked you whether at this point in history, whether it's wise to pursue a career in the social sciences, what would you say?
Oh my God, I would say they've never been more important. So first, as to your point about what we call the replication crisis,
right.
Social psychology has a real problem. We've published a lot of cool studies, really funny, counterintuitive, amazing studies that get written up in newspapers and things like that, and we've been rewarded for doing that. And well, you know, our reward schedule was not good. It rewarded research that was cool rather than careful. So we have a real problem, and we're fixing it. Our field has taken the lead on improving research methods, pre-registering our studies, making our data available to the world. And it turns out almost any field that uses statistics, that is, that mm-hmm. has probabilistic mm-hmm. estimates.
Right.
So it turns out cancer drugs, all kinds of clinical trials are
yep.
shot through with errors.
Yep.
So we are fixing the problem. We're really upping our game.
So be specific.
Now,
I'm sorry. No, I don't mean to interrupt you. Please continue.
Sure. Oh, no. Yeah, no, I'll be specific. So it used to be that, you know, none of us would make up data. I mean, there were a few cases of that, but that was very rare. Rather, what we would do is, as we say, we would torture the data until
mm-hmm.
it confessed.
Right.
Meaning, well, let's try a different statistical test. Let's try another one. And so when you do that, you're likely to get results even if they're not really there.
The results you want
so a
to
lot
get.
Of us,
you know,
yeah,
say
that's
you
right.
can lie with statistics to get to the answer you wanted to get up front.
Yep, that's
like,
right.
Like some
that's
journalists
right.
So, will indeed, you know, they know what they want the article to be like, and no matter who they talk to, they'll find somebody to take their position and the article gets slanted the way the journalist wants it.
Well, that's right. The general phenomenon of motivated reasoning,
right.
which is a discovery in social psychology that we're very good at finding justifications for whatever we want to believe.
Yep.
Well, it turns out it applies to us, too.
Yep.
So we are cleaning up our methods. It's going to be our results, everything published since about 2014, 2015, is going to be a lot more reliable than things published before. So that's one thing. But the bigger issue is, if you actually, a lot of young people want to save the world, they want to make a difference.
Right.
Well, let me give you two ways you can do it. One is you can go out and protest. Now, keep in mind that the things you're protesting for are not well thought through. Your causal explanation for why the world is messed up is not well thought through because your people do not allow open debate. You really don't allow people to question. So the premises of your protests are probably flimsy. The things you're demanding are not likely to work because, you know what? It's really, really hard to come up with a policy that will solve a social problem. Even when experts do it, often those policies don't work. So if a bunch of young people are out protesting and demanding this, that, or the other thing, you know, even gun control, which I very strongly support, and actually the Parkland students actually came up with a set of recommendations that I think is actually quite good. So, I mean, it can be done. But most protests are rather mindless. It's for simple-minded solutions that feel good and that often make things worse. So that's one way, if you could go into social justice activism. Here's another way. You could go study for 5 or 7 years. Often you get paid to do it in a PhD program. And you could try to find communities of people who are really based in empirical research. The 21st century, it turns out, is not going to be the century of AI and robotics and genetics. Yes, those things are important. But you know what? Western democracies are failing. Western democracies might literally collapse. There is no higher calling, I believe, than the social sciences right now. We've got to understand human nature, how it's influenced by social media, why democracy is so hard, why authoritarianism and populism are thriving. These are the most important questions that a young person could devote themselves to.
And if Jonathan Haidt, were 20 years old, a junior at NYU, instead of a big-time professor at NYU and a national thought leader, and you were to pick a new fresh air, you were able to press reset, reboot on your career. You are not chained to the past of your positive moral psychology or all of this stuff. What would you choose today to do your senior project on and then go for a PhD or a master's or whatever in?
Oh, gosh. Well, I love what I do so much that I would just pick the same thing over again. Now, it's a lot later now. It's several decades later. So I think the most urgent thing to understand is the way that connecting people, I would say it would have something to do with either social media, network analysis. It would be some combination of social psychology and sociology. My friend Nicholas Christakis is about to come out with a book. I'm going to read it over the next few days. I'm very excited for what he has to say. Because if you think about it this way, human beings are linked together in a network, and the network has certain settings. And we've somehow evolved to the point where our networks have very, very little violence in them. There's actually amazing little violence in the world compared to 50, 100, 1,000 years ago.
That's what Steve Pinker wrote in his book Enlightenment Now, exactly.
Exactly. That's right. Steve Pinker's, but that's right. I'm drawing on Steve Pinker's work there. So if you imagine our communities in a kind of a somewhat unstable balance, and then suddenly you take the connectivity and you multiply it by 100 overnight, and what happens? Everything goes haywire. And that's what's happening. Our democracy is at a real risk of failing over the next 10 years. I think terrible things could happen. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they're going to. I'm just saying terrible things are now possible that 5 years ago none of us could have imagined. Mm-hmm. The suicide rate is skyrocketing for girls, for teenage girls. It's up 70%.
It's still far lower than boys. That's one of those statistics that's been massaged. Teenagers, 2.5 times as many teens commit suicide than girls. Continue.
No, I know, of course. No, you're right. The overall rate is much higher for boys. That is certainly true. But I'm saying that the way social media has affected boys and girls is different. And the suicide rate for boys is up 25%. You're right. That's from a higher baseline. That is true. But the mental life of girls has been transformed by social media, whereas it hasn't been transformed for boys. Their rates of depression, anxiety are much higher than for boys. So in terms of the overall suffering, girls are suffering more, although you're certainly right that more boys are dying.
Let's end with a softball broad question. Let's think,
okay.
I want to bring it back to the career thing. Make believe, we've got a few thousand people listening to the show, and they're all interested in things related to their workplace. They're not particularly job seekers. Most people are employed. We have the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years. What would you say to the pool of people who are employed, who are not the big poobah, but they're not entry level either? They're in the vast middle. What's something you either haven't said yet that would be wise advice for them in dealing with this roiling environment in which people are polite but very distant and very afraid to give pointed feedback? What would you say to them, period?
I would say go to your local bookstore or wherever you buy books online. buy a book called How to Have a Good Day by Caroline Webb, W-E-B-B. Hmm. It's one of the wisest books I've ever read. I teach a course here at NYU called Work, Wisdom, and Happiness. It's a positive psychology course. And I've tried a variety of formats over the last few years, but the one that works best is we basically take Caroline's book. Now, these are all MBA students. They're sort of, you know, early in their careers, but they're trying to move up in life. We go through Caroline's book, and it gives amazing advice justified by behavioral science evidence on how to have better conversations, how to be more efficient, how to handle email difficulties, how to improve your creativity. It's an amazing book. So basically, I'd say, you know, adopt a kind of a self-help, self-improvement perspective, and then just start getting experimental. Try all sorts of things.
I'm going to take I want to give people something concrete, so I'm going to throw one out, and you tell me, I will not get defensive. I want you to give me your candid response. This is what I would tell people. You need to have cosmic perspective. This is a blink of the eye in history. And all of our passions and roilings about Donald Trump or about Me Too movement or capitalism or Medicare for all or whatever, we have to have some perspective. They're important, but not that important. And ultimately, a society is best when we do listen to the full range of responsibly held positions. And besides, and while I'm not a Christian, the notion of loving thy brother and sister and not being on a hair trigger ready to explode at every nanosecond is ultimately the best way to prevent the society from dissolution the way you just described is now possible in the next decade. So the advice I'd give very specifically is to try to think cosmically. Think in terms of the arc of history. Try to realize that really good listening and respectful exchange and love and kindness is far more likely to move us forward than all of the rancor. What's your honest reaction to that?
My honest reaction is that that's beautiful, is that what we can best do within our local, our companies, our families, is chill out, be more humble, get off your high horse, recognize that you are no more likely to have grasped reality at its core than the person you're opposed, and focus on what you can do well. So I would generally agree with you. The only place where I would disagree is when you say this is a blink of an eye. It might be. It might be that this is a madness that will soon pass, but I suspect it is a madness that will continue and will escalate. It began well before Trump was elected. And it will probably continue after he is gone.
Well,
so I am concerned about the future of the country. But given that we're all on this ship together, I think, yes, the advice you gave about how to be a better citizen of that ship, less self-righteous, more forgiving, I think is very wise advice.
Well, thank you very much for joining the ship of Work with Marty Nemko here on KELW. The book is The Coddling of the American Mind, subtitle, How Good Intentions and Bad Ideas are Setting Up a Generation for Failure, published by Penguin, which is a division now of Random House. Jonathan Hyde, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko.
Marty, my pleasure. What a fun conversation.
Good. Take care and be well.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. As usual, the second segment of the show is about you. It's all well and good to talk about all this high-minded talk. It felt very public radio-y. And that can be a little old, all this good kumbaya talk. It feels good, but I don't, you know, I'm here also to help you in the down and dirty practicalities of your work life. So if you are struggling, and that doesn't mean you're unemployed and curled up in bed with your vape pen, you could be well employed and still unhappy. And it's all fair game. And to be really honest, because this is now in my 30th year doing this, the harder the question, the better. I have heard and seen a lot, and I care a lot about helping you. So if you've got a work problem of whatever magnitude, I invite you to call, especially now when the lines are available. I call them workovers, with pummeling rarely involved, but I'm also a straight shooter. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And as an antidote to John Haidt's a little, you know, worry about the potential increased roiling and dissolution of society as we get ever more polarized, I thought I would share some career change stories that work. I began to plan this segment by jotting down some details about a few of my clients who succeeded in changing careers recently. But as I reflected on it, and I think I projected about what the segment would be like, I decided you might derive more benefit if I presented some composite profiles with nuggets that were drawn from among the literally thousands of clients I work with over the last 30 years. And I'm going to share about, I've got four of them here that I put together. But as usual, I like to prioritize you. So let's go to the phones. I'll give out the phone number again. If you have a work-related problem, I'm here to help you. The price is certainly right. Zero zippo nada here on Work with Marty Nemco and KALW. This is my pro bono work. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, is it me?
It is.
Oh, hi, Marty. This is Nikki in San Francisco. I have a work problem.
Okay.
I was in a bicycle accident in August and had to be on a medical leave for 2 months, and I came back on October 8th, and they said, well, first of all, they delayed my return by a week because they said they were trying to figure out if they could accommodate me. Basically, I broke my lower extremity, you know, ankle, surgery, you know, had implanted pins and rods and all this stuff. And it is a 4-month recovery period, according to my orthopedic surgeon. But they said they would accommodate me, meaning my leg is up as much as possible during the day, and I can do most of my work that way.
Right.
But I do have to ambulate with crutches.
Yes.
And I have one of those black boots. But,
yes.
You know, my month eval is coming up on November 8th, and I am a bit scared that I could be dismissed at will because I have worked there just, 7 months, and protected job status is for people who've been there for a year or more. And so I feel pretty, solid about the work I perform, but I'm on a modified schedule 3 days a week for now, so I can get like continuing physical therapy and doctor's visits, and it's what I need to recover. So I'm working a 3-day week instead of my 4.5 a week. But I'm afraid, I don't know if, you know, there's much protection for somebody who doesn't have protected job status.
Well, first start about, let's find out what you know. And, you know, of course, we all tend to catastrophize. To what extent do you think it would be a good idea to try to get a candid appraisal from your boss about your likelihood of retaining tenure, and how much of any terminating of you would be specifically because of disability, or your boss, he or she, thinks that you're not as good as, you know, the person that could replace you? How much do you know about what's really going on?
Well, I think I know a fair amount, and I think I'm in good stead in terms of what I do. I'm really appreciated by the people I work with.
Okay.
And I think the issue, what I keep hearing, is can I deliver the deliverables to the funder? Because my employer, has me based at another organization, and that organization, you know, has a contract for, you know, the deliverables. And if I can't deliver everything at 100%, you know, they might, you know, think that they can't carry on accommodation for very long.
What is the actual work you do? You write? Do you give talks?
I'm a nurse for the formerly homeless for Glide Community Housing.
I see. And I'm guessing. I've heard only generous things about Glide. I can't imagine that they.
And it's not Glide. It's Glide Community Housing, a separate entity.
Okay, and you know, you sound like a young woman, and it would sound like it's only a very temporary thing that your ankle till you become more ambulatory. Is this a matter of just keeping abreast, you know, doing your part? In other words, scheduling as many of your PT appointments or whatever you need for nights and weekends, keeping your boss apprised of your progress, offering to do a little work on nights and weekends to compensate so that the key deliverables are delivered.
Oh.
I mean, is that real?
That's not an option. They're very strict that I can only work between 8:30 and 5 on weekdays. And there are no doctors and PT appointments on nights and weekends for me. That's why I have the 3-day-a-week schedule also, because to work several days in a row, it's like having my leg down that much. It really gets one and hurts more.
It's
part of my recovery to work every other day and do the therapy and elevate the leg.
And what's the time frame? And when's the consensus that you'll be back to be able to work your 4.5 days?
The surgeon said it's a 4-month recovery period, so that means through the end of the year.
Okay. And so, I would hate the anxiety of not knowing. What do you think? I mean, you kind of didn't respond to my idea, which was to keep your boss constantly apprised, to do whatever you could to get as much done as you could, maybe even to speak to the entity that wants the deliverables and say, hey, I really want to get this to you. This is really important. But doing everything you can so that your anxiety is reduced and you reduce your... There's no guarantees in life, but... Would that be, rather than worrying about just the legal protections, which may be there and may not, I'm not a lawyer, you might want to call your legal rights or get legal aid or whatever, mm-hmm. but in terms of the non-legal things, communicating ongoing with your boss, going the extra mile to the extent that you can without endangering your ankle or whatever, communicating well with also the company, the entity, the nonprofit that's going to get the deliverables, wouldn't that reduce your risk and anxiety to a manageable level?
Well, there is a fair amount of communication going on, and I'm not sure how much more I can really do, because I'm not, I'm really busy on the 3 days I'm there, and I'm not, like, in the office with either of the two entities who I have to negotiate with. Mm.
Those are my best ideas. For the legal side, I'm not in a position to give you legal advice as to what protections you have in 7 months. On the non-legal side, it seems to me that opening communications with all the stakeholders and then doing, and demonstrating your commitment to doing a good job, not just by just where you can without sacrificing your ankle, going the extra mile if you can. That's my best shot for what it's worth.
Yeah. And I did get a lawyer referral for a consult.
Okay. Anyway, thank you for calling Work with Marty Nimmer.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Bye. As I promised, I'll give her the phone number again. If you have a work-related problem, I wasn't at all helpful to her. If I were to rate myself, I made no difference at all. So I give myself an F. Maybe it was not particularly... maybe there wasn't much I could do, but I certainly didn't help. But if you'd willing to tolerate that my batting 0-1 tonight and would like me to try to help you with your work problem, you can give a call here, Work with Marty Nimmer, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. As I promised a couple minutes ago, I was going to tell some composite cases of career change stories that embed some lessons that may be useful to you, because the unemployment rate is the lowest in 50 years. Many more of my clients are now are more open to changing careers because they're not so afraid they won't be able to find a job. So that's why I'm focusing on some career change stories. Here's a career change story about a person who was a psychotherapist who switched to becoming a librarian. Her name is, I'm making up the name, but from way back in high school, I'll call her Alicia. Alicia wanted to be a psychotherapist. She was always helping her friends with their personal and relationship issues. So she majored in psychology, and she went on to get a master's and an MFT license, a marriage and family therapy license. And she was quite modest. She had a pretty easy time in landing a job as an employee assistance firm. Those are the firms that companies hire to help their employees who have mental health issues. And she said that the reason I got a job so easily because her timing was good. The Mental Health Parity Act had just been passed, which requires by law that mental health services be provided to the same extent as physical health. But she was trained in, and she believed in, long-term psychotherapy, and she grew frustrated with the company's 10-session limit. And because her girlfriend had a good, benefited job, she decided to quit and start her own private psychotherapy practice. Unfortunately, she wasn't a great marketer, and so she had a tough time attracting clients. And maybe because in recent years, clients also wanted faster results, she had trouble retaining her clients. So at around age 35, she decided to look for a new career that would still allow her to help people in a peaceful environment, which was important to her. So she got a master's in the library and information sciences. That's the, you know, what used to be called this library degree, but now they call it library and information sciences. Anyway, having heard that it was difficult to land a job as a public librarian, she focused on becoming an academic librarian who specialized in, of course, psychology, because that would leverage her background. And she tried to land a job at a university library near home here in the Bay Area, but she couldn't. And so what she did is she applied to geographic areas near where her girlfriend could be transferred. And after applying for dozens of jobs and having networked by participating in the American Library Association conferences and online forums, she finally did land a job as a psychology librarian at a university in Los Angeles. That's a pretty common kind of, there's a lot of typicality in that kind of a story. Career change style. Let me give you one more. I'll give out the phone number again. You have a work-related problem, want me to try to help? 415-841-4134. That's the number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KELW. 415-841-4134. Now I'm going to tell you a career change composite story from a person who was a guy who was a financial analyst who went or is trying to, you'll see, you'll hear the punchline at the end, become a novelist. The great American dream. Growing up, he grew up in a family in with a single mom, and mom was a gardener, you know, landscape maintenance person, basically. This guy, we'll call him Anthony, he saw his mom's income decline to unsustainably low as the number of gardeners have increased over the last decade. So Anthony decided to aim for a career that would pay well and likely continue to. So he majored in business with a quantitative emphasis, and after graduation, got a job as a financial analyst at a large investment firm. But within months, he grew sad at the thought of a life staring at a computer to decide which stocks deserved a buy rating. And he admired a lawyer who had leveraged his experience as a lawyer to become a successful novelist and decided to try something parallel, to write fiction that was set in financial services firms. He started by, in the evenings and weekends, replacing his TV watching and his video game playing with writing short stories. And it makes sense, because before committing to writing a novel, let alone quitting his well-paying job as an analyst, he wanted to see how readers reacted to his stories. So he posted his creations on his blog, and he submitted them to contests. His blog got some traffic, got some positive comments, and two of his short stories won honorable mention in a contest. It's not exactly a clear sign he should quit his job. But as time went on, Anthony grew more dispirited at the thought that his career was going to be number cruncher. So he was single and unencumbered. He quit and started writing really in earnest, and going to these writers' retreats and writers' groups and reading all kinds of books on writing, and mainly writing a lot every day, disciplining himself to have his butt in the seat at 9 in the morning. The truth is, he's yet to have made more than $100 for a piece of his fiction, but he is supporting his fiction writing dream by doing financial writing gigs for his former employer and for other financial services companies, writing, for example, mutual fund annual reports, letters to shareholders, things like that. He's now acquired a literary agent, which is a crucial first step, and that gives him at least some hope that eventually he will make his living from fiction writing. Again, the phone number, if you would like a, if you're trying to make a career change, or if you have any kind of other work problem, unemployed and having a hard time finding a job, 50 or 60 and still not sure what you want to do, running a business, and you and it's not working well, and wonders some advice. You know what I think I'm going to do? I will give a free copy of my new book, Careers for Dummies, to the first three people who will call. But here's the deal. If you call, you come in and you'll do the segment, and then at the end of the show at 8 o'clock, you have to call back and speak to Joanne and give her your address so I know where to mail it to, okay? So first three callers, who have a work problem, will get a free autographed copy of my book, Careers for Dummies. So it's a hell of a deal. You get free advice here on the air, and then you're going to get a free copy of my book, Careers for Dummies. So if you would like a work over, the phone number here at KLW, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now I want to tell a story of a composite case of a fundraiser who made the unusual switch to wanting to go into tech sales. Usually it's the other way around. We'll call this person Michelle. And she was nonprofit oriented from the get-go. Although she was growing up and attending college in Silicon Valley, she majored in sociology and in college described herself as a social justice warrior. So after graduating, she got a job at a women's nonprofit by arguing that because she was young, she could be an effective fundraiser for the many young women now hired in Silicon Valley. But she had a hard time giving convincing yet honest answers to tough questions from potential donors. And one question really stumped her. Indeed, it rocked her. The question was, what's your evidence that my dollars donated to your charity would make a bigger difference than if I gave it to other charities, or even if I invested it in my company's stock, which makes products that improve the lives of every customer? And Michelle had no answer for that. And that shook her, and it made her look for a job selling software for a company that she believed might, as the questioner asked, make a difference in more people's lives, or more clearly make a difference. And in her networking, and in her job applications, and in her interviewing, she argued that the skills that she used in fundraising were those that she also would use in sales. And it actually took her quite a while and quite a focused search, invoking her network a lot and repeatedly, but she finally landed a job at a company that did sell a well-regarded app for managing anxiety. And that's a third of the career change stories. Again, the phone number, if you would like a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And the final career change story I want to tell you is about a botanist who made a switch to something called program evaluation. David was always bookish and mathematical, and he got a PhD in botany and landed a job at a leading food grain company. And his goal was to use gene editing to try to create more disease-resistant and protein-enriched wheat for export to developing nations. But the progress was far slower than he had hoped, and after a year, he decided to switch to a field with faster progress and more novelty. He had grown bored of just working on the same project for a whole year, so he Googled on such terms as statistics careers and research methodology careers, and he discovered the field of program evaluation. He applied for jobs at evaluation firms and government agencies, and he landed a job evaluating innovative education programs for the U.S. Department of Education. Now, these composite stories may imply that career change is easy. I certainly don't want to say that. It's not true. Many of my clients who attempted a radical career change like the ones I just gave you ended up deciding to just do a career tweak of their existing career, get their job description changed to accentuate their strengths and preferences. They moved to a new boss, they moved to a new place of employment, or they upskilled so they could make a modest pivot within their career. For example, a psychotherapist taking a course in counseling interracial couples. But if you're unhappy in your current career, I hope that those anecdotes provided some ideas and maybe even some inspiration. Anyway, last time, give out the phone number. Phone number at Work with Marty Nenko for a workover, 415-841-4134. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Marty. First of all, thank you very much for such a helpful show. I've been listening since I moved here in April, and I've quite enjoyed it.
It's a real privilege to do it. How can I help you?
So I'm in sort of a pickle. I'm in a little bit of new territory. Let me give you a little bit of my background. I'm a professional accountant who have Big Four experience, and I just moved here.
You have what experience? What experience? You were speaking a little bit fast.
Big Four. Sorry, I have Big Four experience working with some of the
Big Four. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
So
for those who don't know,
here,
it's like Ernst and Young, and the big accounting firms. Right?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead. Now consulting firms.
And I came out here. So initially, when I came to the firm that I'm with currently, they tried to place me at one of their clients, but that didn't work out. So I actually came and joined them, and it's a consulting firm. And they now have sent me out to a client. Mm-hmm. And the client now, I got along with the team, and I like the experience that I'm getting, and they want to hire me full time.
Mm-hmm.
But my current consulting firm says they never do that. They don't let their full time employees go to their clients, and there's like penalties involved in something.
Right.
So I'm now confused. Initially, they were able to do that, and now not.
Right.
So I'm not sure what's going on. I just want to get the experience and continue working with the team I'm
right.
working with.
Now, sometimes what has worked for a number of my clients, I had a client who, frankly, I could say the law firm, I'm such a big firm, Wilson Sonsini, probably the world's premier intellectual property law firm, they have a wonderful lawyer who was working on behalf of Wilson Sonsini for this client in the biotech industry. And my client loved working for this biotech person. And but of course Wilson Sonsini appropriately didn't want to lose her, and in fact this biotech company was originally Wilson's client. So she was completely transparent. She had a three-way meeting with her boss at Wilson and the boss at the biotech firm, and said, "I want to continue working for Wilson, but I'd like to spend more of my week working for this biotech company." And they worked out an agreement so that the crucial work that Wilson wanted her to do for her law firm got done, but she still had X number of days a week that she could spend working for this client. Have you tried that, and would that kind of transparency work in your particular company?
So that's what I've been trying. You know, like, I actually talked to the manager that I'm working with and my firm as well, but what they do is they just end up talking directly to the CFO, like my owner just talks to them, and they never make me part of that conversation. So I'm only getting sides of it, so I'm not sure, like, to what extent I can just have a meeting with both of them. Can I actually just call them out to a coffee and have them talk in front of me, or I'm just dealing with them individually at this point, and that's what...
No, it should be a three-way. It has to be a three. I would definitely not go around your boss here unless you want to risk getting fired. And you say, there sounds like there's some rules. So I would have this talk with my boss and say, would it be possible to have a three-way conversation, either just me, you, and this client, or me, you, the client, and the big boss, so that we could see if we can put our heads together to come up with an agreement that wins for everybody? Does that make sense?
And I know there's money involved, so maybe that's why they don't want me, because I know what they charge me as to the client, at what rate, and I know what they pay me, so they have a good margin. And if they let me go, probably to full time there, they'll just get a one time commission. So change from
I'm not being clear. I want you to stay an employee of your big four firm at your current billing rate.
It's not a big four firm. It's a smaller firm.
Whatever.
That I moved to.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But I want you to continue to stay in the employ of that firm, but have more of your time. You say you want to work for this other firm to get this experience, so that your company doesn't lose any money. It's going to bill you out at the same rate, but that it is officially okay to be allocating more of your time working with this particular client. That's what I'm saying. You should put your heads together, the four of you, your boss, your boss's boss, the client, and you, and see if there's a way to make that work for everybody's advantage. Does that make sense?
Okay, that makes sense.
Does that make sense? Have I lost you?
No, that makes sense.
Okay.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Great. I thank you for calling Work with Marty Nemke. Your timing is perfect. The show has just ended. Perfect.
Oh, awesome. Thank you very much.
All right, take
great
care.
Talk to you.
And that is Work with Marty Nemke for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, I'll talk with Heather McDonald. She's the author of The Diversity Delusion. Until then, this is Marty Nemke reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us. Growth among those who don't.